Welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
All right, everyone, welcome to the podcast. I'm Mike Scheimer.
Tim Bergreen.
Mike, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Tim?
Doing well. It's a beautiful Friday afternoon when we're recording this and looking forward to the weekend. But before we get there, we've got a very, I hope, interesting discussion today on the recently released National Security Strategy and National Defense Strategy. I don't know whether you've had a chance to take a look at either or both of those, Mike, but wanted to get your thoughts.
I've looked through them. So we had the National Security Strategy released initially, and then all at once in October, you know, we have the National Defense Strategy. At the same time, I believe DoD also puts out the Nuclear Posture Review and the Missile Defense Review, which are really tied to the National Defense Strategy. But they're great things to talk about because they're kind of hitting related but two different parts of our national security practices, right? So we've got the National Security Strategy comes out from the White House, you know, from the Biden administration. This is the strategy for the executive branch on national security. And then about a month or so later, DoD puts out the National Defense Strategy, which they're not necessarily the same thing, right? So that's one thing we've already touched on, is that national security doesn't always mean the Department of Defense. But, you know, I had a question for you just about your history on the Hill with these things, right? That these are, my understanding, you know, really because these are unclassified versions, and a classified version is transmitted to Congress. We're obviously not going to talk about classified information on our podcast, but this is the stuff that's out for public consumption, right? So, you know, I'd like to hear sort of your experience historically about when these would come out in prior administrations, right? What is the usefulness of these strategy documents for Congress?
You know, I spent a bit of time before we sat down this afternoon thinking about that, because to some extent, you know, these things are somewhat useful in sort of framing an administration's, you know, overall goals. On the other hand, for the amount of time and effort that's involved, the number of people who have to have input and clear on everything, what you get out of the back end is not necessarily something that's sort of intellectually stimulating or is necessarily going to drive real policy. Take a look at the National Security Strategy this year, right? You know, along with the usual sort of hard power types of emphasis, and then also diplomacy and multilateralism, et cetera, there's actually a lot on, you know, strengthening our economy at home. Now, I will be the first to agree that having a strong economy at home is sort of the bedrock underpinning of our national security strategy. On the other hand, if you're spending a lot of time talking about stuff like that, you're not necessarily framing issues in a way that, you know, is really all that useful to me. But that's a little bit of my viewpoint. I will say that when I was the staff director down at the Intel Committee, I tried to kill off a lot of reports, both before they were offered as amendments, and then also ones that were sort of zombie reports that somebody had put in years before that end up requiring lots of contractor time every year or two and aren't necessarily delivering any value for the taxpayer or augmenting our national security. You know, I guess to some extent they're less useful inside the government than they are for think tanks, I guess. You know, they get a lot of mileage out of them. And then also, I do think that there is some utility, diplomatically speaking, in that you have a document that sort of lays it all out for anybody around the world who wants to read sort of what the general thrusts and underpinnings of American strategy at that point in time are.
Yeah, those are great. I want to pick up on some of the things you said. I guess the first one for our listeners would be things like manage your expectations, right? So to be clear, these documents they're out there. There's been a lot of talk about them sort of in the national security space, you know, both in think tanks and pundits and in the media. But there's only so much you can sort of read you know, read the tea leaves here, right? Because some of this, and these will be, this is some of my overall comments on reading the national security strategy and the national defense strategy, is some of this isn't really new, right? Like if there was a sea change in policy here with the Biden administration, I think we would call that out right away. But there's sort of minor shifts, right? Certain prioritization changes. One of which we can come back to is, I think it's been helpful to note that, like, compared to prior administrations, we've got China and Russia aren't sort of lumped together per se. Like there's, I think, language in both the national security strategy and the defense strategy that talk about China is the global competitor and Russia is an acute threat and a problem, if you will, but they clearly drop them down a notch. Okay, so that could be kind of useful to look at there. And then another point you said too about, like, diplomatically, which I think is interesting here, is this is signaling, right? This is, these documents are publicly available. The audience isn't necessarily just Congress, even though Congress, I believe, like under Goldwater Nichols, requires these reports, right? But it's for the U.S. public. It's also for our allies, so they can sort of see and hear when the administration is, you know, committing to the NATO alliance or to economic issues. And it is also a message to Russia and China, I think, too, which is helpful, that they, you know, they'll see this. There are certain things you either choose to say or not say after this has gone through all the workshops internally. And I'll just, one other last point I want to make is I completely agree with your point about reports that have to come out of executive branch agencies. My time as a defense contractor in the Pentagon, I saw a lot of required reports that Congress had mandated. And then it just becomes a situation of, we got to throw people at this. This report is due. With all respect to the Pentagon, this is why I think some reports may come out later than Congress mandates, because it is a bit of a distraction from their primary mission. So that could be another discussion. I have seen some commentators even talk about, is it time to do away with the congressional requirement to put out these sort of strategies, right? Or even the bigger ones like the Quadrennial Defense Review. I don't necessarily agree with getting rid of these, right? But there are definitely tons of other reports that Congress mandates that may take executive branch agencies away from their primary mission. I mean, one option here would be for some of these things is, could there be a way to make these strategies a little more useful for what I think Congress and the public want to know about? So one thing you mentioned about, like, you know, investing in our economy, I can see in the national security strategy reciting sort of the accomplishments we already made, right? Like the, you know, the CHIPS and Science Act. And, like, I think there are a couple other mentions of, I see the National Biotechnology and Biomanufacturing Initiative. You know, so we're investing in all these things. And then it goes on to say, we're going to invest in other cool technology. But if I were reading this, you know, on the Hill, I go, okay, great. Like, do you have a proposal specifically? Or are you just going to take credit for the things that actually passed and then not lay out? Because it's supposed to be a strategy, right? This is a strategy. What is the strategy to then invest in the next cool emerging technology?
The other thing about strategies is that they usually, you know, involve choices. And all of the above is, you know, not really a viable choice, right?
Yeah, you can't have everything, right? So there's got to be, there needs to be trade-offs, but you don't really get that from this, right? About, like, we will prioritize this, recognizing that that means Department of Defense or some other agency may not be doing something like modernization or, you know, whatever it's going to, like RSA Army modernization, not to pick on their programs, right? But, you know, we don't get that from these strategies right now, that they're clear trade-offs have been made.
And strategy, you know, I mean, it involves, you know, also aligning ambitions with resources. And from my time doing appropriations work on sort of foreign operations, you know, we have sort of grand visions for our influence around the world. And unfortunately, the resources that we're able to bring to bear for all but a handful of security challenges, you know, really is not as great as I think a lot of people think it is. You know, we do a tremendous amount in the global health area, but we could be doing more, I guess, if we wanted to align sort of the outcomes with the desires that are in the document. So, but that's a discussion for another day. You know, I'm just wondering, you know, thinking about kind of the clients of our firm, you know, are there any things that leap out of the of either of these that you think are of interest to them?
Yeah. So one thing I do want to highlight, which is, you know, sort of a topic that I think, you know, sort of dear to my heart and relevant to my practice, is the, you know, what's around the corner? What are the next, you know, critical and emerging technologies that will be vital normally I say just for the Defense Department, but really it's broader than that for national security. Some of that is already in here. We do have the CHIPS and Science Act, and so that's in the semiconductor supply chain there. There's a lot for that. But there's other references throughout here and things about, like, I think there's, again, the biotechnology, and I think quantum computing might actually show up in both of these documents. And so investing in those are things I'm always looking for, and I think clients that are in the technology space, they want to see, oh, good, here's an opportunity, right? Like the government has said that this is important. So particularly like to say, I think this is more in the national defense strategy, but to talk about, to compete with China in the technologies you and I have talked about before, and we'll talk about more on this podcast, like artificial intelligence and quantum computing and directed energy and even the drone space, right? The U.S. needs to be more, I guess I would say, more rapid in its technological innovation. And that's something that's always been a challenge in the more traditional government contracts space that I operate in, is, you know, rapid acquisition of the force was something years ago when I worked in Army acquisition was a challenge. And we would have emergency justification because there were operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. So there were ways to do rapid equipping when there's emergencies. But otherwise, you know, our programs take a long time, and not just like ship programs or the next, you know, generation fighter. All government programs take a long time. So my takeaway in the technology space, you know, for our clients in this area is, okay, it's clear, and we have been hearing this from government for a while, so this is not that new, but like this is helpful to have it in the strategies, is if the U.S. government is going to try to compete sort of in great power near-term competitor with China, then it has to invest in some of these technologies. And then my question, you know, as a counsel for industry is, great, where are those opportunities, right? Because the CHIPS Act tells us where those are going to be. Well, what about the other ones? And that's where we get into situations like, okay, thankfully, the Congress recently reauthorized, you know, SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research Awards. That SBIR program was kind of up in the air until I think sometime in September. Great. So SBIR awards are available for the small emerging tech companies. That's good. A lot of clients we talk to in these technology spaces don't want to be a traditional government contractor, but they want to be in this cool space. So they'll think about, okay, what about other transaction agreements or OTAs? Or I don't want to have a contract directly with the government for them to buy anything yet, but I could use their support and investment. So you get things like a SBIR grant or CRADAs, Cooperative Research and Development Agreements. I'm going to do a CRADA with the government. There's all these tools that the government can use and has been using more of. I'll give them credit in this cool technology space that we operate in. They've been using those more and more in recent years. So that's where I like to direct clients in these critical technology spaces, is what can you get? What can you do with the government? What's the opportunity? I'd like to see sort of more of that coming from the government. There's more national security innovation opportunities rather than just like, I need to buy a fully realized product. No. This is the time to be doing R&D. And I'm, you know, I don't have the numbers on this now, but I think I was just hearing the other day about like the big technology companies, Silicon Valley companies sort of combined have done more in R&D than the Department of Defense has its R&D budget for like the last year.
I believe I've heard statistics like that as well. You know, and actually, I want to come back to this discussion actually next week when we talk about Ukraine. Because I actually think that these issues are really live there. You know, I'm just to give you kind of what I got out of this, kind of from looking at it from a point of view of a business. You know, I think that this is, I think the sort of architecture, if you will, of a post Cold War world is becoming clearer. I think you're seeing sort of the budding of sort of parallel economic and perhaps even sort of cyber ecosystems. You know, I think also, you know, on a positive standpoint, I think that the sort of the reaffirmation of the importance of alliances as sort of the secret weapon for the United States and sort of the commitment again to working multilaterally. The bifurcation of, you know, where we're going to compete with China and where we're going to cooperate with China, I think is really important also. You know, you see that in the October 7th orders by Commerce, which were extremely tough and sort of decapitated, if you will, Chinese access to certain high tech computer chips. But at the same time, you know, legacy chips, if you will, are unaffected. And I think that's sort of, you know, this is an example of that. Again, you know, compete where you must and then cooperate where you can. And so I think that to me, those are things that leap out that say what the parameters are going to be like. And I think that that should help some of our clients and others to sort of begin to think about how they're going to navigate the next few years. And it's obviously going to get a lot more complicated. We've not gotten any kind of pushback yet officially from the Chinese, you know, as to what their consequence, if you will, is going to be for the October 7th rules, but I'd expect they're going to do something. But those are sort of some things that leapt out at me and I think are somewhat reassuring. Obviously, you know, a change in administration can mean that this is not the way that we're going to go. But considering that this is something, if you will, that was begun a little bit under Obama, that President Trump definitely pushed and is seeing sort of a flowering under Biden, I think there should be a bipartisan interest in moving this way going forward. So those are kind of my takeaways.
Yeah, there was a good line that I liked in the national security strategy that I always have for listeners is that the PRC is the only competitor with both the intent to reshape the international order and increasingly the economic, diplomatic, military, and technological power to do it. So it's not new that there's been a competition with the PRC. But again, as much as the strategy documents, you know, don't really take strong positions, I think that's pretty clear here. Maybe a little more of an assertive statement than we've had in the past is that, okay, the U.S. government or this administration is acknowledging that the near-term competitor is the PRC. Russia is a threat to the international order, but they're like one tier down. And so, and we see this in sort of in our practice and things from just classified contracting and security clearances, foreign ownership control or influence or foci in my practice a lot. The focus in those areas a lot is primarily on China as the threat and Russia to a lesser extent. And that's pretty clear on this. And so I think a takeaway on that point for companies is, okay, the message is there, right? That this is where the competition is going to be. But as you've already pointed out, you know, there's areas where we have strong trade connections, right? So like the BIS rules don't affect older technologies, they affect the new stuff. So companies kind of need to make some decisions here about like, all right, well, there's this stuff here again to get back to investments, strategic investments in the United States, like the stuff in the CHIPS Act. The government, U.S. government has said, here's the technologies you want to invest in. But you mentioned trade-offs earlier, even in the context of the strategy. There's trade-offs for business they have to think about here that I think you get the message here from some of these strategies is, okay, here's the technologies the U.S. government has said are important we want to invest in. But you can't go into that as industry and assume that I can do that and, you know, accept U.S. government funding and also, for example, have, you know, supply chains or sources or contractual relationships perhaps with the PRC. That's going to be the trade-off is if you want to accept government funding in certain areas, you need to be very clear that this may be a situation where you got to go, okay, we're going to be doing this in the United States. We can't be offshoring some stuff. It's a supply chain question and it's also just a business decision about we may need to decide where we're going to sort of build these things, right? Now we've seen that kind of already in certain technologies, but that was my takeaway in some of the technology points here that you don't have to just be a U.S. government contractor traditionally with a security clearance to recognize that you may be getting pressure more and more from the U.S. to decide if we're going to offshore your operations and your supply chain.
One other thing that I wanted to mention here, you know, there was a fair bit of talk in the national security strategy about democracy and democracy building. And, you know, that is, I think, an issue that clients need to be sort of thinking about as well. I don't think we want to go into the domestic situation on this podcast right now, but we're living more generally, I think, in a time of sort of political tumult and instability. There was a recent hard right turn in Italy and Sweden. Israel just reelected Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, who brought along some extreme right-wing parties with him into the new government. And so I do think that that is the one wild card, I guess, that people do need to be thinking about. And I know, you know, that clearly the leadership of the United States is, but you know, that is something that's kind of out there.
And we don't have to get into this too much, but you know, given the upcoming sort of midterm elections, right? Do you have any views on when a strategy like this comes out, would a change in, you know, which party is dominant in Congress, would that have significant impact in the goals laid out in here, or would it be, this is national security and a lot? And then again, some of this we have noted is not inconsistent with the prior administration. It's kind of taking it and maybe reordering some things, but there's nothing really a complete flip per se. But what, you know, what would be your views on, would some of these things that I mentioned, the strategy, be sort of now dead in the water if there was a change?
You know, I think some of the, I guess, economic and, you know, sort of some of the industrial policy type of vision that the administration has, I think some of, you know, what they consider about sort of democracy improvement and strengthening at home have to involve a legislative fix, you know, that presumably would not fly in the upcoming Congress. But I do think, look, I think, you know, China, the emphasis on China is going to remain. I think the Russia piece, and we'll talk about that next week a little bit, is a little dicier. I think there's, you know, some erosion of support, if you will, both among congressional Republicans and then among Republicans, you know, at large for continuing to help out Ukraine to the extent that we are. So, you know, there are, you know, different emphases. But as I noted earlier, when you have a document that, you know, says we'll have, you know, one of everything, please, and you can't afford to have one of everything, please, you know, one of everything anyway, you might as well just take what you can get and call it a win. I'm hoping that enough of the general thrust of this, because, it, you know, these are, most of this is common sense stuff in both documents, survives as sort of a framework. You know, my earlier beef with it was sort of the breathlessness with which it is, you know, greeted when it's put out every few years.
I don't know if we want to go down this road or not, but I do find it interesting that there are some topics in here that, and I feel like this is a, this comes and goes, depending on administrations, right? But there are sometimes opportunities to suck in other things and say this is part of a national security strategy or the national defense strategy, like the climate change questions and some other things. And that may be relevant maybe for like international security and stability. I could see that, like certainly, you know, passages through the Arctic, right, have been a thing, a challenge with Russia over the years, right, who has the icebreaker ship. So I get that. But some of the stuff, as I read through this, it sort of seems to sweep in things that maybe might be too attenuated from what we would call national security, right, which is, you know, we've talked about lots of things can be connected to national security, but at the end of the day, it's the nation, and in this context, at least the United States, the security of the nation. And there's some other things in here, I think, that maybe are maybe a little outside what we would normally consider that lane. And so I'd like to hear your thoughts on, as you said, trying to include sort of everything. I go, well, look, you know, some of the stuff is requires international action, right? And so you're saying this is more international security and stability, but there's a difference between that and then things like the investment in critical technologies here in the US or transforming the force under the national defense strategy in the US. And so I don't necessarily disagree with some of the things that have been listed in here, but as I read through them, I thought, wow, you're adding a lot of stuff here, right? That is kind of maybe outside the typical national security mission. And I wonder sort of how realistic it is to include that in the, if this really was a strategy, which I think we agree it's not really a strategy, but if it really was a strategy, why are those in the strategy?
So, I mean, if you look at sort of the three pillars of it, right, and things that it calls for, you know, investing, right, in tools and in sources of American power and influence, building a coalition, alliances, and then modernizing and strengthening our, you know, military. And I'm going to throw in our intelligence community for strategic competition. And this other stuff, the investing at home, kind of the affirmative engagement, all that other stuff, those are enablers, right? The strategy is the super big picture stuff. Look, right now we're just dancing on the head of a pin. It's a little bit, you know, reminds me of that old, what is it, Henry Kissinger argument, why are academic arguments so fierce because the stakes are so small. you know, ultimately, I think it's an important exercise that you know, people at senior levels of government are doing this. I just, my question, you know, ultimately is this the right way to do it? Is it the best use of resources when we have annual threat assessments coming out of the IC? You have the budgetary process every year with, you know, all of the agencies, you know, DOD, state, the IC, everyone else. And so I'm wondering, you know, to what extent this really adds a lot of value. I think if the National Security Council wants to draft something that is really more of a vision statement of the administration, great. And maybe it'll be a little more piquant and, you know, not have been cleared by 50 million people around the Beltway. So that's kind of a little bit, you know, my beef. Wondering whether maybe it's time for us to go out and enjoy the afternoon a little bit and wrap this one up. Really enjoyed chatting with you about this. Very much looking forward to our next episode, which I think is going to be on Ukraine, where I think we're going to return to some of the themes that we've talked about today and last week. But anyway, in the meantime, you know, have a great weekend.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. So we'll be back talking about the conflict in Ukraine, and there will definitely be some connections to the things we talked about in the national security strategy and our discussions about China, and we will pick that up in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.